Welcome to Nuclear Matters from the Australian National University College of Systems and Society. I'm your host, Liz Williams, a nuclear physicist and nuclear systems discipline lead for the ANU School of Engineering. What roles can citizen science play in the governance of nuclear technologies? In today's episode, I explore this topic with Michiel van Oudissen, Associate Professor of Public Participation in Science and Democracy at VU Amsterdam. Michiel previously worked at the Nuclear Research Center in Belgium and had the opportunity to study citizen science initiatives focused on managing nuclear technologies in both Japan and the European Union. As you can imagine, those contexts are very different. We explore what he found in his work and discuss how these lessons might apply to the Australian context, particularly with respect to the growth in our involvement with nuclear technology due to AUKUS. Let's listen in. Hi, Michiel. Thank you so much for joining us today on Nuclear Matters.
Thanks for having me.
I reached out to you because I was interested in the work you've done in Europe and Japan on how societies respond to nuclear technologies and their impacts. And I say that because Australia is embarking on a kind of new journey with regards to its use of nuclear technologies, particularly around submarines. And I want to get a sense of how other citizens in other places grapple with nuclear technologies. So I'm hoping you can help me with that. Where did your interest in citizen science initiatives begin?
So I self-identify as a science and technology studies scholar, right? So a scholar who looks at the interactions between science, technology, and society, how these play out, and then how we can govern them. So it's all about governance, as far as I'm concerned. So how can we do this responsibly? For instance, by involving citizens in decision-making on science and technology, right? In decisions that might affect them now or in the future. Mm-hmm. And so citizen sciences, I think, has emerged over the past couple of decades. I mean, it has a much longer history, dating back to the 90s, even the 80s. You could go further back. But as a term, it's really become a thing now. So where I'm based in the Netherlands and in Belgium. Mm-hmm. It's really endorsed by governments, national governments, and by the European Commission, for instance. So everyone's advocating for citizen science. That comes from this realization that, when you try to develop new sciences or technologies, or you try to implement some kind of innovation, citizens want to have a say in that, and they'll talk back if necessary. So what fascinates me about this is how members of the public or groups, for instance, social movements, how they talk back, and then how that then impacts science, technology, and innovation governance.
I want to unpack that a little bit. You're interested in citizen science as a mechanism for governance effectively. So that begins with some kind of measurement or observation. Can you talk me through how that process plays out, how it impacts the governance side of things with regards to these technologies?
It depends on where you are, right? So I've done research in Japan, but also in Europe. And I mean, they are different contexts, right? They are quite unique. But I think what we see time and again is what I was mentioning earlier, that public speak back. So, for instance, with genetically modified organisms, right? When that agenda was implemented or authorities tried to implement it, that created an enormous backlash in Europe, for instance. Mm-hmm. And to this day, we are very strict on this. So it's usually issue driven, or at least that's the type of citizen science I'm interested in studying. So emanates from the bottom up, as we say, so from the grassroots. Mm-hmm. So it could be activists who protest against a certain technology, or perhaps more creatively, for instance, in the nuclear arena or in the nuclear field, they might begin measuring radiation themselves using their own technologies or devices because there's an issue that concerns them. Mm-hmm. So it's very much issue driven and very innovative, I would say, in how they mobilize these technologies, how they develop their own responses to a pressing issue, sometimes because governments fall short.
Right. So one of the papers that I read that you were involved in, you were looking at citizens in Japan who were, as you said, measuring radiation, in particular after Fukushima. I was struck by your discussion about how there were different perceptions and risk that were playing a role there. Can we talk about how different public perceptions of risk are
informing the kind of citizen science that might get done and also the kind of impact that science might have on the governance of a technology?
Yeah, it's a big question. So I think as an SDS scholar or researcher, I think I should say something about risk and risk perception first, right? So the way I think we look at it is it's not just about whether people overestimate or underestimate an objective risk, so to speak. The question of what constitutes a risk is always bound up with histories, and it's always part of a wider context. So, and what constitutes a risk is negotiated between different actors. So even what counts as a risk depends on, for instance, institutional agendas or societal norms. Mm-hmm. In Japan, there's this entire history. You know, of course, they have this nuclear legacy, which goes back to the Hiroshima and Nagasaki events, but also pollution disasters in previous decades. So there's all these factors to take into account, which are more or less unique to Japan, although you could also draw links with events in Europe, such as Chernobyl, right? That has really impacted Japanese society, you could say. And so then to make sense of your question, I think risk perception plays out quite differently depending on that context.
Yeah.
So the Japanese context is going to be different than, you know, what you have in Belgium or the Netherlands or elsewhere in Australia, I would imagine. One way, like one thing we've observed in Japan is that many of these citizen science organizations, they are intent on measuring or at least answering basic questions, right? Especially in the aftermath of the Fukushima nuclear disaster, they were concerned with, is the food safe to eat? Mm. Can my kids play safely in the sandbox, in a playground, that type of thing? So they're very localized, they're very, situated. And this gives rise to a certain type of citizen science and a certain risk perception that's close to the community, right? It's close to your body even, right? So in a physical sense, it's temporally situated, although they might ask questions about, you know, what is this going to do in the next couple of decades? But also institutionally, I'd say it's a different scale because it's the local scale rather than the scale, the scales that, for instance, credentialed experts are concerned with or official authorities, right? So governments, the central government, for instance.
Yeah.
And that's very different from Europe, for instance, where there's been this, they tend to say this or use this term, so this institutional uptake of citizen science into research policy.
Mm-hmm.
There's this notion of responsible research and innovation, right? You could say it's like it's become a guiding vision for the European Commission. Although they now speak of open science, but it's related. It's about taking into consideration societal values, expectations that, you know, for instance, what concerns citizens when a new technology is developed or implemented.
Mm-hmm.
The reasoning behind responsible innovation is that we have to innovate responsibly, obviously. So we have to consider society's needs, expectations, and values. And all of this has to be aligned. And then we can move forward together as a region or as a community. Whereas in Japan, the relationships between, for instance, citizen scientists and the central government are much more antagonistic.
Mm.
Right? So there's not this sense of togetherness. A lot of these citizen science groups are seen as being anti-nuclear, anti-government, even anti-citizenship in a way, because the notion of citizenship itself is contested in Japan.
Interesting.
So it's a very different setup. Well, that influences risk perception, right? So just to go back to the example of the sandbox and so on, right? It's not necessarily about getting an accurate, scientifically validated measurement of the radioactive pollution in the sandbox. It's about getting just good enough data to act on.
Mm.
So what they call actionable data, which is different than the what credentialed experts or scientists are usually after. They want the most accurate type of measurement.
Yeah. For Japan, if they're doing measurements to figure out whether there is radiation in the sandbox that they might need to be worried about, they might want to make a decision based on that data as to whether they're going to let their children play there. The larger scale impact of that is, it sounds like there's no translation of those kinds of smaller scale measurements and decisions to larger scale policy decisions by the government. Is that right?
Yeah, so that's one of the things, one of the recurring challenges, you could say, in Japan, and where, you know, there's, you know, quite a number of citizen science groups in Japan. They call themselves citizen radiation monitoring organizations. And they have tried to organize themselves because government, according to them, at least the central government, falls short.
Right.
So after Fukushima, there was an information void. It wasn't like the central government wasn't sharing the data, or they were sharing wrong data or inaccurate data.
Mm.
And so people were clueless about what to do, right? And where to go to. So they're just trying to answer basic questions. And this is the void that then these citizen movements filled.
Yeah.
So one notable example is Safecast. They're based in Tokyo, but they're more of an international volunteer organization.
Mm-hmm.
And they have developed their own measurement devices to measure radiation pollution in the environment. And it has been very successful, not just in Japan, but elsewhere as well, because they share their data online. It's open source. You know, anyone can access it. Anyone can download the maps.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives you at least some sense of the radiation levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they try to do is they try to complement the official measurements. They challenge and complement, you know, the data coming from official sources. So in that sense, I do think there is some translation going on.
Yeah.
In the sense that at least credentialed experts, but also the government officials have to pay attention to these citizen movements, if only because they can be quite destabilizing for the science and research system, right? That's if only for that reason.
Yeah.
And it impacts on safety. And as we're seeing, because organizations like Safecast are still around many, many years after the Fukushima disaster, so they're probably doing something right, right? They're having some kind of social impact and scientific, I would argue.
Yeah.
It's more about these groups challenging the official narratives and the official measurements and so on, for instance, by doing mobile measurements, right, which wasn't happening.
Mm-hmm.
And at best, this then prompts the officials to start paying attention.
Yeah.
And so I think on the international level, organizations like the International Atomic Energy Agency have started paying attention to these forms of crowdsourcing and have even acknowledged their potential value.
Interesting.
So something is shifting there, but it's slow and perhaps happening too late. I don't know. That's an open question.
It's interesting, though. I have an interest in safety as something that is contextual, and it seems like the emergence of this kind of phenomenon came out of a feeling of lack of safety as a result of lack of transparency from government. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, so I'd say in Japan, yes. I mean, it also depends on who you ask, right? So having worked at, for instance, the Belgian Nuclear Research Center, many of my colleagues would argue that the central Japanese government did all it could and did well.
Yeah.
And this is coming from credentialed experts working in dosimetry, for instance. If you ask citizens on the ground, you're going to get a very different story, right? So I think they would acknowledge, for the most part, at least based on the research we've done in these communities, is they're saying there was, you know, the government fell short. And they said even more, they said, we don't want to be measuring. We don't want to be doing this work, but we have to because we're being left to our own devices.
Yeah. Right?
There's no support coming from above.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is one of the things that interests me, right? There's safety is in physical safety based on what we understand about how radiation interacts with the human body. And then there's safety with regards to, I guess, psychological safety. Do I feel safe in this particular circumstance? And those are two different things.
Right.
But both are important. And if you're focusing on one, you could potentially end up making a different decision about how you manage something. Can we go back to the Europe example? And it seems like there's a much more proactive approach from the start. I'm wondering, can you give me a sense of how that plays out, particularly for nuclear technologies?
Well, that's a tricky one because the nuclear field, or I like to call it an arena, because it's always contested. It's always hot, right? Or it can be, or it often is. So often you see, especially in the history, like over the past couple of decades, there's been a lot of anti-nuclear protests. You know, a lot of those have taken place, and anti-nuclear movements going against state authority and so on. But I think when it comes to citizen science, there is this sense of, okay, even the nuclear industries and nuclear research and technology, so that is gradually opening up to more participatory approaches, right? So
mm-hmm.
also at the center where I was, where I was working, you could note there's this at least this rhetorical shift in terms of, you know, it's not just about coming in with a nuclear program, for instance, how to deal with radioactive waste. And we're going to decide, announce, and defend that approach. It's called the DAD approach, right? That's the jargon. So I sort of like the acronym because that approach obviously is not effective. It doesn't work. So coming back to the point I made earlier, it's the publics are going to speak back.
Yeah.
And they're going to contest that, right? And they're going to confront you with it. So it's going to have to be more interactive and participatory. And then you stand the chance of co-developing solutions to pressing problems. But so to come back to your question, I think Europe, but also some of its member states, particularly the Netherlands, they're taking a lead role on this. They're really pushing the citizen science agenda, trying to involve citizens in science and technology and innovation mm-hmm. through processes of dialogue, but also by inviting citizens to collect data and then analyze them together, decide on what to do with the output. So it's become very co-creative.
Mm.
And that's just, I think, what the European Union stands for and advocates, right? So
yeah.
it's all about dialogue. It's about cooperation. It's about participation. Like there's areas, I say, which possibly less contentious, like having citizens count birds and then sharing these data with scientists, and it's all good fun. It's very different from the nuclear arena, which, where you can't share all of your information, for instance, because there's a lot of secrecy involved. There's safety issues.
Security.
Yeah, security as well. It's a very different setup. But overall, the European approach has been to, I guess it's what we stand for in Europe, is bring all the stakeholders together around the table and then forge a consensus or a way forward. And citizen science sort of feeds into that logic.
So who participates in these kinds of co-creation processes in Europe? Like, do you have an example? It doesn't have to be from nuclear, but do you have an example where, you're talking about many stakeholders? I'm trying to get a sense of, like, what does that look like?
That's a good question, because it also points to the limitations of public participation in science and technology. So who participates? They're usually considered or called relevant stakeholders. So anyone with a stake in the matter. So it probably helps to work with an example, like take plastic pollution, right? That would involve decision makers, certain industries, certain communities, maybe people who live close to the ocean. Maybe it's about plastic pollution in the ocean. It depends on the issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the reasoning behind, well, I'll just, for the sake of simplicity, I'll call it the European approach, like the approach to of responsible research and innovation. It's about finding out who these relevant stakeholders are and including as many voices as possible.
Mm.
And obviously, that doesn't always work in practice. Not everyone feels included. There's always power dynamics at play. Some citizens are going to be interested. Others are not. There's large groups of people who we don't reach, right?
Yeah.
And when you look at citizen science, you just look into the research. It could be minorities. It could be certain populations who don't have the time to become involved. They don't have the resources, et cetera, et cetera. So there's always groups that are left out in any of these processes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something to be aware of. But so I think, again, the approach, at least in theory, is to make this as inclusive as possible and then to move forward. I think one of the big challenges we're facing now with citizen science is that it can be appropriated by right-wing groups or anti-scientific groups as well, who claim to be doing citizen science. So I sort of we're moving away from the nuclear now, but this is
right.
To draw a parallel. It is actually relevant to say this. Some of the citizen science groups that have sprung up in the nuclear arena are not taken seriously by the credentialed scientists and vice versa, right? So there is a lot of mistrust, not only in Japan, but also in Europe, because some of these citizen groups are seen or at least perceived as being anti-nuclear, anti-science maybe even.
There's a perceived agenda. Is that part of it?
Yeah, at times there's a perceived hidden agenda or not even a hidden agenda, but some environmental groups have mobilized these data to argue against nuclear technology.
Mm.
There's nothing new to that. Yeah. I think where citizen science sort of has potential is that many of these groups are such a safecast. They're not arguing for or against nuclear technology. They're saying we're pro-data, right? So they're trying to sort of carve out the space in between the more activist groups like Greenpeace and the official institutions and saying, look, What we're trying to do is to get a sense of, or like, to deliver or produce accurate data, but we're not pro or anti-nuclear, right? We're sort of in between, where we're occupying the space in between. And of course, you can question that, right? I don't think data are ever neutral, but this is how they're presenting themselves.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting line to try and walk, right? If you are putting data out there,
yeah,
it can become a source of power depending on how one chooses to use it, right?
Exactly.
But it sounds like what they're trying to do is just say, look, here's the data. You can do with it what you will. Can we explore how power dynamics play a role in all of this with regards to, you know, data collected by citizens potentially used in these kinds of ways?
Yeah, well, I think power is key and something that's not always explicitly acknowledged in these processes, right? So in Europe, the at least official like policy discourse is bring people together, we'll work it out, we'll figure it out together. It is like this enactment of harmonious pluralism and a belief in togetherness. But you have to ask the difficult or the tricky questions, right? Is who decides, who has influence? So let's take the example of citizen science as one way of contributing to responsible research and innovation and open science. It happens on certain terms, right? And these may be set, for instance, by initiators. How actively are citizens involved? You know, are they involved in the problem framing from the very start? Do they only collect data? Are they maybe involved as co-authors, on a publication? I'm not saying more is better, because I'm actually quite skeptical about that. I think sometimes it's good if citizens only deliver data, if they're okay with that, right? So a couple of years ago, this was 2018, there was this big air pollution measurement campaign in Flanders, which is the northern part of Belgium, which is where I'm from. It was called Curious Noses. And the initiators, the citizen scientists, managed to mobilize, I believe it was 20,000 citizens across the whole of Flanders, right?
Wow.
And all these citizens did basically was deliver data on the amount of nitrogen dioxide in their immediate environment. So, you know, in the street where they live.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave this to the experts. The experts then went to the lab, analyzed the data, and published this with the national news media. So that had a massive impact. And despite the fact that citizens weren't really involved not in any deliberative way, they were simply delivering data, it impacted policy. Like, for instance, it led to the emergence of low emission zones in cities.
Mm-hmm.
It led to behavioral change. Like, all of a sudden, air pollution was a serious thing to consider.
Right.
And so this is why I say that crowdsourced citizen science is just similar in the way that Safecast is doing it in Japan, can also be empowering, right? And even if you're not involving citizens in all stages of the process, it can have a massive impact for the better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we tend to want to manage what we measure effectively. So if you're not measuring something, the likelihood that we do anything about it is low.
Yeah.
So I can imagine if you all of a sudden have a lot of data about a particular area and it suggests that something needs to be done.
Yeah, because I've spoken with a lot of citizen scientists over the years. So it's what the Curious Noses people, but also the Safecast group in Japan was doing, is trying to get this on the policy agenda, right? Like, everyone or lots of people sensed that air pollution was a thing. It was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just, you know, a decade or so ago, like, you still had politicians denying this, right? And not taking it seriously. But through this campaign, it became, I like to call it a thing, because I think a thing in sociological sense, like, yeah, it's become politicized in a good way, right? It's being taken seriously and people are talking about it and they're changing their behaviors and so on. So it's being taken seriously.
Yeah. Is this getting easier to do, at least in some circumstances, with, for instance, cheaper sensors, smaller, cheaper computing, all of those kinds of things? Like, is it easier to roll out these kinds of things so that you can potentially have that kind of impact?
I think there's no question that it is, right? So with the rise of the internet and the Internet of Things, but also microsensors, nanosensors, if you look at how the Safecast devices, you know, what it consists of and how it is assembled, a lot of design thinking has gone into that based on technologies that are available that can be easily be mobilized. Mm-hmm. So they worked with designers in making this as intuitive as possible and so on. It's a mobile device. It also, it's aesthetically pleasing to the eye. All these things, you know, factor in.
Yeah.
And yeah, of course they rely on high tech or, well, not even, you know, it could be low tech technology, but at least technology that has been developed in the past couple of years. So I think there's no question that that plays a significant role here.
Mm-hmm. Kind of back to Australia. I know you have not done work here. I'll give you a little bit of a background. We're looking at acquiring conventionally armed nuclear-powered submarines, and we're in the process of looking at what it means to stand up a nuclear-powered submarine workforce and bases and all of the above. And one of the big questions that I have is the current social license for that kind of work in Australia, particularly given that we don't have civil nuclear. We do have nuclear industry, but it's fairly limited. Yeah. And primarily focused on front end of the fuel cycle. So I'm curious, are there any lessons we could learn or anything that we might want to think about, given that we are embarking on this journey, particularly with regards to, you know, the social license side of things, the publics that might have a say in all this?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they do have a say, but maybe they're asking to be involved one way or another. I don't know, because I'm not that familiar with the Australian context. I mean, there is this challenge of, you know, militarization. It's also happening in Europe. I don't think the public has much of a say in what's going on in Europe at present, right? It's governments deciding to invest a lot more in national security and regional security.
Yeah.
But I do think we can learn from at least my past experiences with public participation in the nuclear arena, because again, what citizens or members of the public typically want is they do want to have a say of some sort, right? There's obviously issues of security and confidentiality which play a significant role here. But citizens do want to be able to trust their representatives, and they do want to be able to trust their governments. So I think you still, you know, if I were to reason as a government official, or even an industry representative, I think I would insist on clear communication, right? Being as transparent as possible at all times. And if you're not able to be open about something, you have to be explicit about that, right? You have to say, I can't be open about this, but such and such, right? And I do think you could fund local monitoring, you could fund citizen science initiatives, or, provide a space for independent expertise. Because often these community groups led by citizens are considered to be much more independent and much more trustworthy. So that's certainly something that we see in a country like Japan, where every time that there's a disaster or a crisis, mm-hmm. people turn to the local communities. They turn to the citizen science groups because these are considered much more trustworthy than the central government. So it's a way of developing these partnerships as well, and shifting perhaps from one-way risk messaging to trying to create more of a dialogue. And again, it's going to be very tricky in the area of security, but I don't think it's fruitful to exclude the public as such, or the citizenry, right? That especially in a country like Australia, a democratic nation, I don't think people will take it. But I don't know, maybe you can also speak to this, because I'm less familiar with the Australian context.
No, look, I agree with you. Yes, there are certain things that have already been decided, right? However, people do have a say. People do have a say with regards to, for instance, you know, what we even do with the waste, which we are going to have to deal with. All of, you know, in principle, to do all of this, we actually need a plan till end of the time where we're going to have to look after that fuel, which is a very long time. And so that has been a continual challenge for Australia already. So just even looking at that part of it, we have a lot of work that I think we're going to have to do to get to the point where we have a plan for that that is acceptable, and that the public's that might be interested in this particular issue will be comfortable with. I know you've done some work on deep geological repositories, speaking of which, for nuclear waste. I'm wondering what you found there, particularly with regards to differences in risk perception and how different stakeholders thought about that or think about that for the cases that you were looking at?
So when it comes to geological disposal, I think, you know, here is to me, it's just characteristic of the nuclear field. I think it's, in some places, I think there's a growing consensus that that's the way to go about this, right? What do we do with high-level radioactive waste? Deep geological disposal. I would consider this to be a wicked problem in the sense that there's uncertainty about the science, right? We don't even know what goes on in the deep underground necessarily. In one of the European projects I was involved in, scientists noticed that there was microbial activity in the deep underground, right? So some peers were open to that. Some regulators were open to hearing that message. Others weren't, right? They're like, no, it's contained. It's passive, right? Mm-hmm. But so there's uncertainty about science and the values are disputed, right? Like, why is there even radioactive waste in the first place? That's probably not the most generative question, but, you know, there are people asking this. So I think stakeholder engagement here is key, as it is with any kind of wicked problem. So you're going to have to involve a variety of stakeholders early on. And I think the example here to follow, at least there is perhaps a consensus on this among policy elites. The example to follow is Finland, mm-hmm. where they had this whole process over decades of early research assessments, local involvement of communities that would be affected, including compensations, then moving to regulatory approval mm-hmm. and public consultations. So throughout. And so I think you can temporarily close these discussions, but they're going to be opened time and again. Yeah. And it's very hard to see how even experts would agree on one particular solution or approach. It's just going to remain contested. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep trying, right? I think the legitimacy of the credibility hinges on the approach, right? It has to be not something like a quick fix. It has to be something that it's developed over time. And when you generate new insights, you might change, for instance, the structure of the repository, or you might come up with new principles, and you involve as many stakeholders as possible throughout the entire process. Mm-hmm. That's the only guarantee I think we have, or it's the best we have. Let's put it that way.
Well, it's one of those things that's quite challenging. I mean, the subs are still a hypothetical thing, at least for us, but realistically, we and many other countries have nuclear waste that we are just going to have to deal with. And so at some point, ultimately, we have to figure out how to move forward on that, or it just sits in storage forever, which we can think about whether we like that or not. Have you been involved in some of the consultations on these facilities? And can you talk about how kind of differences in risk perception might have come through in those discussions?
Well, I was tangentially involved. I think most of my colleagues were involved in this, or they were involved more directly. I think it's more tricky with the type of, if it's high-level waste, for instance, you're obviously going to get a different type of discussion and risk perception than with low-level waste. I think it's fair to say that with the low-level waste, we, and by we, I mean the including the SDS scholars or researchers involved in this, we're able to facilitate an approach whereby stakeholders found each other and came up with a solution. So in the north of Belgium, there's at least one site where, you know, they've created these kind of tumuli for low-level waste, and this is happened in consultation with the local communities. They've been compensated and so on. And it's, you know, based on notions or principles of, for instance, retrievability. So experts or whoever should be able to retrieve the waste if necessary, take it elsewhere. So there are success stories out there. Sometimes we tend to forget this, right? Mm-hmm. So in terms of risk perception, I think you have to consider, there's always many factors to consider. The type of waste in this case, the type of stake, the histories leading up to this, you know, if you, and that's why it's so fruitful to compare and contrast, because what happened in Japan, like Japan's got a very different nuclear legacy than, for instance, countries in Europe,
yeah.
Australia. And of course, there's always similarities as well. So what can we learn from these situated responses to the challenges?
Yeah. You mentioned retrievability. It almost sounds like there's a set of values, or you know, you can sort of identify a set of values by which perhaps stakeholders can agree on how to move forward. Is that part of the process?
I do think it helps to like if you take the ladder abstraction, and so the higher up you go, right, the more abstract it becomes. Yeah. Like if you have these guiding principles, usually people, or some at least, can agree on principles, right? Mm-hmm. So then how do you make that tangible? Like what does it mean in practice? But so retrievability might be one of them. And I think many people or stakeholders would agree on that principle. But then there's certain regulators, or at least in some countries, experts might say we don't want retrievability because we believe in passive safety. Mm. So the waste takes care of itself, right? We don't necessarily even need oversight. So I'm not sure that you find a consensus or even a compromise among different stakeholders, but perhaps this works in the country of Finland, right? And so then we have to respect that, right?
Right.
That each nation might develop its own approach to managing high-level radioactive waste, for instance. It's messy.
Yeah, I know. You mentioned passive safety, and I remember reading in one of your papers a discussion about that and whether passive safety is actually passive. Can we talk about that for a moment?
Yes, I think what we were doing in that paper was we started from the context, the regulatory context and the policy context, where actors were drawing that distinction between passive and active safety. And we argued that even if we assume, for instance, that you can bury radioactive waste in the deep underground and it's going to be contained and take care of itself, right? It just takes thousands of years. Even that's going to need some kind of monitoring or oversight, right? Because you simply to implement the technology, right? So it's very ambiguous, especially if you look at how things are written into like official documents and so on. It's quite ambiguous, and the whole notion of, you know, that is that binary, that it's either active or passive, is just flawed. We were arguing, so it might make more sense to reframe this as not being a debate about passive versus active safety, but about the types of oversight that we need, because there's going to be even minimal forms of oversight in any situation, even with passive safety. And then I think this is where I think we make a contribution, is like if we reframe this a little, then maybe we can have a different type of discussion which is more generative.
Mm-hmm. So what does that look like?
Oh, that's a good one. I think that's where the paper, like that's where we ended the paper.
Yeah, I know. I want to know. Where do we start with that discussion?
Well, I mean, I do think you have to, like, let's say you're a regulator and you insist on passive safety, but if there's all this, you know, at least I would say there's all this scientific evidence mounting up, but there is some indication that, for instance, microbes are doing something in the deep underground, right? They're eating away at the waste, supposedly, right? I don't even know what that means necessarily, but there's uncertainty about the assumptions on which the whole safety structure is built, right? So then you have to take these to heart, I think. You have to, at the very least, be willing to hear this and engage with contending viewpoints or evidence. And then you can talk about, okay, so what would this mean for oversight? I don't think that necessarily means you have to give up the notion or the approach, right, of passive safety, but you're probably going to have to tweak it or something, or you're going to have to consider, you're going to have a contingency plan or something, right? But again, as an STS researcher, I would really insist on having those difficult conversations in the interest of, in this case, long-term radioactive waste management. If not, you're going to run into problems down the line. And this, you know, we can even show this empirically and historically, is that that tends to happen all the time. So you might also want to involve publics in this, because they're going to have concerns and questions for you, which you may not even be considering. So it's really about the process rather than, you know, me giving you a fixed answer or a solution to the problem.
Right. So it seems like it's a matter of respect. So listening to people's concerns and saying, okay, I can understand where you're coming from, as opposed to saying, well, it's a passive safety system. There's no issue. Like, we don't have to think about it. Is that kind of where you're going with that?
Yeah, I think you have to take people seriously. So they have concerns, they have questions. Sometimes they have quite a lot of knowledge that, for instance, credentialed experts don't recognize, are not willing to validate, right? Don't consider, or don't, they just mm-hmm. simply don't take seriously. So you asked me at the outset about how I got interested in citizen science. And one of the first papers I read was a paper published in the 1990s by Brian Wynne, so an SDS professor at in the United mm-hmm. Kingdom. And he was describing how after Chernobyl, there was some of the nuclear fallout in north of England, so in Cumbria. And the government had then decided to restrict access to the land, right, to remove the sheep. And there were certain measures in place without taking into consideration not only the values, the concerns of the local farmers, but also their knowledge, because he describes how the sheep farmers actually saw changes in the landscape, in the soil and that type of thing, which the credentialed experts hadn't even noticed, right? So they were reasoning more in terms of modeling, or I don't know what the details of it are.
Yeah.
This just, to sensitize ourselves to the fact that you have to take people's knowledge seriously. They might know things and they might value things differently than the credentialed experts. And so if you want to govern your way through these issues or challenges, use that knowledge to your advantage. Some would say because that's the ethically right thing or the sound thing to do. I'd say because it's more effective. Yeah. Like, that would be my primary driver in this. I just think it makes more sense to use or tap into people's resources and knowledges rather than excluding them.
I'm gonna be honest. At some point in my past history, I had somebody correct me when I told them knowledges was not a thing, and it is a thing. And so what you're talking about here is people who maybe have different philosophical viewpoints as to, how the universe works, etc. And they could, from that point, have different ways of going about constructing knowledge. That process might look different, and it might feel very different than maybe a perspective of an expert that's been trained in scientific method, etc. But there is often value in those perspectives and those ways of forming knowledge that are not at first glance accessible to somebody who hasn't been used to working in that way. I guess, is that a reasonable way of looking at this? Like, is that a helpful way of looking at this?
Yeah, I think it is. So I think that aligns with what a lot of scholarship in science and technology studies is about and is trying to achieve. Ideally, then, that would lead to better processes and better inputs, better throughputs, and better outputs as well. Mm-hmm. And it's also, as I was saying, like, for many, like, the ethically right thing to do, if, we claim to live in democracies where people affected by decisions that are made by power, or let's say by elites, right? If these affect these people, then people have a right, or they should have a say in these processes.
They're going to most likely know better than the elite making the decision as to what the potential impacts of that decision are on them. In most cases, not all.
In most cases. But I do think there might be exceptions when, for example, like in a very, an immediate, or let's say an acute crisis situation.
Yeah.
There might not be any time for any of this, right? It's just about decide and else defend. That comes back into play. Like, on these rare occasions, governments have to resort to that approach. The problem is that we see this approach as being the dominant approach, or a technocratic approach as the only way to go about dealing with crises and disasters. But there's the whole phase of preparedness, like something we really insisted on when I was working at the Belgian Nuclear Research Center, was about emergency preparedness and also post-recovery. And ideally, you learn from these processes, right? So that when a crisis hits, and it hits hard, you're better prepared and you're better able to to manage the all the challenges and all the problems.
So basically, you need to prepare for those things in advance. You're not going to be able to predict the future. You can't prepare for all the things, but you can at the very least go, well, things might happen. Yeah. Let's figure out what it might look like to manage that well, from the perspective of a range of stakeholders.
Exactly. Yeah.
I feel like we've had a very wide-ranging conversation, which is lovely. And thank you for letting me ask a bunch of questions that I didn't send you in advance. But is there anything that we haven't touched on that you might like to share with our listeners before we go?
Well, what I'm excited about now at present, because I've sort of, I did a lot of research on nuclear science and technology in the areas of emergency preparedness, citizen science, and so on. But what I'm trying to, or what I'm interested in now, and what is something I've become really more attuned to, is this notion of mundane governance, right? Where a lot...
What is...
Mundane governance is taken from the work of Steve Woolger, among others, right? It's about the everyday management of science and technology, often in unobtrusive ways, ways we don't care to notice. And so when you apply this to the nuclear arena, there's always incidents. You know, there's incidents which we're not aware of, which no one notices, and which are managed. I've become much more interested in how these are managed and how they're managed well, if they are, without them being visible. And I think that's crucial. First of all, I think we have to be appreciative of this. So there's all these mechanisms and so on in place, which perhaps work. I don't know if they work, you know, depending on how you define that, but also what this performs, what this does. So I'm reminded here of, I once saw this Monty Python sketch where they were sitting in an airplane, and then the captain said, "And here's an announcement: there's absolutely nothing to worry about. Everything's going fine, right?" So, of course, this then generates anxiety among the passengers simply because this message is being shared with them. So, by virtue of the message itself,
right,
is what I'm saying. So, there's something in crisis communication and in non-communication where you always get it wrong.
Yeah.
And where if you're trying to take incidents or potential issues, you're trying to take them seriously, but simply by doing this, you're already creating anxiety and problems and a crisis, really. So, this is something that fascinates me, and I think more research needs to go to that, because I would consider it a paradox or a dilemma, you know, like you can't get crisis communication right. Mm-hmm. It seems to be really, really tricky to get it right.
Well, that sounds really interesting. I'll have to have a look at that body of work.
Exactly. Yeah.
I do have one last question. Sorry, I just thought of one. I'm wondering if there are other areas of technology that we might draw some lessons from. Are there places where what's happening in, aviation or whatever can be applied to nuclear in a useful way based on your experience?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think, but this is basically because I've been reading a lot of Charles Perrow's work. So he was an organizational sociologist, right? And wrote the book Normal Accidents, where he's saying accidents have become normal. Because our societies have become risky, right? So there's no way around technology. And the problem, as you saw it, is when these technologies become very tightly coupled and complex. And so, yes, you can learn a lot from aviation, because things generally on the whole seem to be going right. But if you look at our systems today, and also for instance, nuclear power plants and so on, they've become very tightly coupled and complex. So they're really hard to manage. As soon as one thing goes wrong, that could lead to a cascade of effects, and many things could go wrong which could have been prevented. So he was very wary and very cautious, right, when it came to nuclear technology. Yeah. But you could argue that many of our systems today are becoming tightly coupled and complex, and then question whether this is a good thing or not.
Yeah. No, I think about that all the time. I mean, Charles Perrow's work, that started with Three Mile Island, right? I mean, idea of normal accident started with his work on Three Mile Island. And so that's one of the accidents that I keep going back to, not because things are exactly the same. I mean, the nuclear industry has learned quite a lot since then, but but it's the complexity and how that played out in that particular accident that interests me quite a lot. Particularly when you start to think about, like, I don't know, we were talking about, you know, novel technology. For instance, embedding artificial intelligence in its various forms in these kinds of facilities. And what does that do in terms of this tight coupling? It makes things more complex, certainly. Like, how do we deal with that?
No, I'm not sure how to deal with it either. I was talking to a pilot the other day, and they said, you know, you don't even need pilots anymore to fly the plane. It will do it by itself, right? But people don't trust, or most people don't, right? So there we're back also to the...
So you still need a pilot?
Yeah, apparently. For most people, I'd say. Yeah, there's always people who are probably... There's probably people willing to get on a plane without pilots. But most of us would like some kind of human oversight, I think. So how to deal with it? I don't know. That's a big question. You're right. That's for next podcast, I would think.
Yeah, a whole nother episode. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. I found our conversation really interesting, and I'm hoping my colleagues in Australia think the same.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Nuclear Matters is a production of the Australian National University College of Systems and Society. We acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which this podcast is being recorded on or listened to, and pay our respects to their elders and all First Nations people. If you liked what you heard today, please share this episode with friends, family, and colleagues. If you want to send us some feedback on an episode, please email us at nuclearmatterspodcast@anu.edu.au. Keep in mind that this podcast is intended for information and education only. The views and opinions expressed in each episode are those of the individual speakers and do not represent the official policy or position of the Australian National University College of Systems and Society or the university as a whole.